Episode 3. No blue, no green. Welcome to our podcast, Stand Up for Reefs. My name is Kate Holden, and today we will be talking about no blue, no green. Our guest is award-winning Belgian photographer, Ellen Couillertz. Ellen captures images of ocean wildlife that are serene, peaceful, and strikingly intimate. She seeks to create work that is almost otherworldly, ushering her viewers into a realm still so foreign to the human collective. Her objective is twofold. She seeks to bridge a deeper connection between humanity and nature, and she also works to capture her own experience as the photographer, how it feels in those moments when she's behind the camera. Before we meet Ellen, let's talk about what No Blue, No Green means and why it's relevant to our Stand Up for Reefs campaign. No Blue, No Green is a phrase made famous by Dr. Sylvia Earle, who founded Mission Blue. Humans occupy 29% of the earth via the green, or simply the land that we live on. Yet 71% of the world is ocean, and the ocean governs the systems that make earth habitable. Every drop of water we drink, every breath of clean air is linked to the ocean. 97% of the world's life comes from the ocean, and there is one global ocean, and 25% of all marine species are dependent on reefs. That's the one statistic I want people to take away from this podcast. As humanity has evolved and our numbers have grown, and we have developed mind-blowing technology, especially over the last 100 years, our impact on the earth has gone from marginal to significant. And this impact is beginning to interfere with the natural processes of the environment. What No Blue, No Green really simply suggests is the ocean is incredibly important to our earth systems and therefore our lives. Interestingly, Mission Blue, Dr. Sylvia Earle's foundation, identifies hope spots around the world. And Little Cayman, where CCMI's research lab is located, is a hope spot. So there are places where oceans are resilient and rebounding, especially where protection plans and blue economy, meaning the ocean resources are recognised as important assets that must be used sustainably as an intrinsic part of the economic model, which is often the only language big corporations will really listen to, are being developed. So if you are listening and feeling a bit glum about the state of the oceans, nature is showing us a way and we are learning as rapidly as possible. I think what's very interesting about the context of the ocean and therefore coral reefs is that not only do the threats cover a vast array of academic disciplines, but the solutions span even more complex dynamics across science as well as governance, industry, business and society. The issues and solutions are not just cause and effect, therefore, and for the general public, this makes the whole concept extremely confusing and in many ways disengaging. The calls for collaboration across the world, across multiple industries, are getting louder, and the reliance upon us, on society, to learn as much as we can and get involved is only going to increase. And this is where ocean advocates like Ellen Couillertz come into focus. Not everybody loves science, although some of my colleagues would disagree, but Sir David Attenborough's outstanding documentaries, such as Blue Planet, have indicated very clearly that humans absolutely love our oceans, especially the animal characters that we've got to know via this kind of documentary. And if there is a human connection to the ocean, then there is definitely the hope needed to create change. So let's meet Ellen and find out how she stands up for oceans and coral reefs.
Hello, Ellen, and our topic today is No Blue, No Green, which Dr. Sylvia Earle made famous, and the phrase hopes to highlight the importance between the oceans and humans. So we want to hear about your work as an ocean advocate in what I think is one of the most compelling and important ways, which is through your lens. So firstly, what do you love about the ocean and coral reefs?
Well, thank you, Kate, for the kind words, and thank you and CCMI for hosting me on this Stand Up for Reefs podcast. It's great work, and I'm honored to be able to be a part of it. So why I love coral reefs and the ocean, actually, because it's they give us life. and 25% of the marine species which we need depend on coral reefs, and 50%, just imagine that, of oxygen is produced in this ecosystem. The planet relies on the balance, and it's all about preventing the tropic cascades. So we can't remove any part of this ocean. And that's why I love the oceans. They give us life, and why I work to protect them, to protect the balance in it.
Did you always have an affinity with oceans growing up?
I always had an affinity with nature. So I love to observe nature, just the clouds, everything that lived in my little garden. We have, a very small garden when I grew up. I think it was 4 meters by 3 meters or something. But I love to look at the grass and everything that lived in it. I love to go to the parks and watch new life in spring, the frogs. I'm an observer, and I try to connect, and I want to feel nature. So once I started diving, I wasn't a happy diver at first. So it was 2011. I did a try dive years before that, which I absolutely loved because of the how it made me feel, very zen, very calm. Mm-hmm. And then I started to get back into diving in the Cayman Islands. And my first dive, I didn't like, because I didn't know enough about diving, I think. Mm-hmm. So I started learning about it. And the more I felt at ease underwater, the more I could become that observer again, which was before.
So did you get into photography? When did you get into photography?
Actually, the moment I started diving. Because
really?
Yes, once I started studying this diving and being more in control underwater, which actually happened quite fast, because I really wanted to know everything about it. So even when I was doing my open water, I was reading books about dive mastery and stuff. Ah. I really got into it. And then in the water, I was a bit, call it bored, maybe.
Yeah.
I was used to homeschool my 2 children, which with questions the whole day, and we are addicted to learning. I planted that seed also in them. We always want to know more. We're very curious. And then I was underwater, and it was a bit, I needed something more. So I actually picked up something I couldn't study because it was very expensive, photography. But I just treated myself. I was 41 by that time. And I just said, let's be nice to me and buy a little camera and take it underwater. And let's see where it gets me. And that is what happened.
Isn't it funny sometimes that just by putting the camera between you and nature, that creates the focus?
Yeah,
the lens for you to be able to not only relax your brain but really focus on what's in front of you. Whereas maybe when you were just diving, you didn't have that focus.
Yeah, I observed in a different way. I observed, but there were too many factors. You know how the diving goes when you have to dive with the group. There were too many factors that were distracting me, and I was actually, again, like I did before, because I have 2 children with high functioning autism, they're now adult and they're doing absolutely great. But I was focusing on the other divers in the group and not focusing on me.
Yeah.
And I needed that lens to just be in my little world. And still, if there was a problem, I would still help them.
But yeah.
I really needed to focus on myself for a while.
I think it's amazing that in taking your attention and giving yourself the break to focus on yourself, you actually have focused on nature in such a huge way, which we'll come on to in a minute. But that's quite interesting that your focus has very much just gone from one priority actually to another one, even though it's a much more worldview.
Yeah.
Even if it's by accident, that's pretty cool.
Like you can focus on helping everybody else. And I was always engaging with nature? I was always engaging with people before and with nature. And I was always trying to help, like help the weak and coming up for kids that were bullied in school. But it was time to do something for me. And by doing something for me, I could really do something for nature. And that's a nice evolution, I think.
Yeah, that's amazing. So your work has a very special feel to it, and you definitely engage with the animals you're photographing. So it's not that you're just watching them. I think that what makes your photographs, which are stunningly beautiful, we can put a link onto the website so people can see your work. You connect. And is that something that you consciously learned, or did it come naturally to you?
It was very naturally. Like, I always connect, whether it was to people or to nature. I observe. I don't want the subject to be an object. It really needs to be a subject. I want to understand it. I want to know how it thinks, and I want to help it too. So
there's so much evidence now, compelling research that's coming out too, that's saying by having that subjectivity with nature, and for a lot of people, particularly from the marine and the ocean perspective, creating an identity and a connection between humans and particularly the wildlife is possibly the strongest and best way to create not only protection for them, but to maybe give an impetus for change within us so that we can support them, which I think is, I think what's tough is that it's not somebody that everybody can just do. And you see the, you know, like the David Attenborough biographies or the documentaries where those guys spend months and months and months, you know, in situ to get the shots. And this takes us very nicely into my next question, because you have visited some really exceptional places in the world. And could you highlight which have been the most compelling and important to you, certainly in terms of our topic of no blue, no green?
Well, the one place that is closest to my heart, I think, is Île de la Madeleine in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. It's a place where I go to take images of the harp seals. Pups of the harp seals.
Yeah.
You can say, well, no blue, no green. This is a talk about reefs, but it's all connected. The oceans are connected. So to me, that place where I have been visiting for, I think, 7 years, but, well, I did 7 attempts and I only been there 3 times.
But oh, wow.
It's hard to get to because... actually, those harp seals, they breed on ice. They need ice to breed. They need it to give birth to the pups. And then they nurse them for 2 weeks, the moms. And then the moms, very promiscuous, they go back to mating and they leave the pups on the ice. And they have to survive on the fat reserves they have.
Yeah.
But it takes another 2 to 4 weeks, and then they start swimming, they start to molt, they start to swim, and then they can hunt by themselves, and they're actually adults. Mm-hmm. It's a very sad story, because when the ice melts, pups drown. When there isn't ice, the moms don't know where to give birth, and sometimes they give birth on this very thin ice, and then the pups drown. When there is too much ice and it's too cold, the pups have a hard time too, because minus 40, minus 45 is also not ideal.
Yeah.
When there's too much wind, the ice stacks on top of each other, and it's the pups also get hurt and might drown or worse. So the mortality rate in a bad ice year is up to 100%. The mortality year in a good mortality rate in a good year can be from 30% to 70%. And to me, these harp seal pups, to me, it's the eyes of climate change. They have these big, big puppy eyes. They're just the cutest ever, the most innocent creatures. And I truly think by telling that story about animals needing eyes to breed, and then seeing firsthand that it's not so easy to have the perfect eyes to breed anymore, it's that's the most compelling place to go to. It's also hard to get there. And it's the most close that you can get to being a witness to what is changing in this world. It's a bit the same as like polar bears, they need the ice to hunt.
Yeah.
And I've been in Svalbard twice, and then you see the ice just being in a very bad condition. It's also heartbreaking, but the pups are easier to approach to and to take these images that just get people very interested in what is going on, because who can resist these cute creatures and then find out about the cruelty and the harshness of survival.
I have a trilogy of seal pups actually on my office wall that I bought at an auction that you very generously donated to. And they are, I will put a link to your website, because they are the most incredible. Like the one I'm looking at the moment, this pup is literally just looking straight into your lens. Yeah. With these big, beautiful eyes. And there's also the cleanness and the naturalness of the white, the white of the pup, and then also the environment that it's in. It's really quite something. It's very, very meaningful. And there's something about nature in that setting that I think everybody can connect to, regardless of the fact that it's for many people millions and millions of miles away.
It's the most pure environment also. And know that it's actually having a hard time to just form the eyes every year and being thick enough. And then last year, well, actually 2020, we went back and we couldn't get there on a boat, because that's the way we visited the ice floes before. And we had to go on a helicopter, and we were in the water also, and we saw the pups drowning. It was just
awful.
Yeah, but it's the most pure, and it's also who doesn't relate to them. Yeah.
So your work, I think, over the last 10 years now has really grown. And funnily enough, I think I sent you a message. I was reading a UN, I think it was a 2030 document, and I opened it up and there was your photography. So you have really not only coupled what you love about nature and making photography your career, but you have also become a very strong ocean advocate. So is that something that just happened? What did you do? How did it come about?
It's actually who I am. I try to think about how can I explain, and some people mail me and they say, how do I get to doing what you do? I can't explain it, because it's who I am, and I try to protect the weak. It was always in me. So just taking images that are beautiful was just not me. I always wanted to do something with the images, and if I could tell a story, I did. And it started with a lot of local initiatives in the Cayman Islands, the sharks, protecting the sharks, and working with actually giving information to DOE and connecting people to get these species protected, and getting the shark sanctuary installed between the three islands. It was always, how can I help? Who do I know? How can I just connect the right people? And it's, I can't explain why I do it. It's just me. And in a way, sometimes I think to myself, oh, I just want to be in the field and take images, but it wouldn't give me the satisfaction that I have by just accomplishing things behind the scenes that I'm very happy with. I don't need the recognition. I just do it because actually maybe it's what I'm good at, instead of making it a big thing. Just be quiet and just do it. Be a mover and a shaker.
That's super interesting. So we have actually the second episode of the podcast, and we had Dr. Emma Camp. I don't know if you remember Emma, because she was in. Yeah. OK, so interestingly, she was a scientist with a difference that always, from very early on, said, look, I don't just want the science to happen. I really need to make sure that it becomes advocacy, and that it's communicated, and that if people are interested or they want to engage with it, they can. And I think that there's obviously a very common theme, because you feel the same way. And that's actually, interestingly, totally unprompted from me. So It obviously, I think that really sets people apart. You know, you can just do your work, whatever it may be, and do that to the best of your ability. But there are those people that actually take it to the next step in terms of trying to make a difference, which if everybody who wanted to or felt comfortable enough did that, I think that, you know, that's where you see really amazing change.
Yeah, because change doesn't just happen by everybody just taking nice images and sharing them on Facebook. It's not really going to do a lot.
No.
I have to also be realistic. There's not one day I'm having a day off because I'm in the whole time and I'm at my computer probably more than I should. It's hard work, and sometimes it is quite depressing. But then when you meet people or you get things done, it gives me the drive to go on.
I had somebody ask me the other day, actually, and she said, you know, you work with coral reefs. And I said, yes, I'd not met her before. So we were just having that kind of top line, hi, how are you? What do you do conversation?
Yeah.
And she said, do you not just find it massively depressing?
Yes.
And I said, you know, yeah, some days I do. Some days there, it definitely feels, you know, if, you know, there's a disease outbreak on the reefs in around the Caribbean. And there are times when you're like, oh, you know, this is just too awful. And, you know, can we really make a difference? You know, can we make, you know, or help deliver change? Because it just feels like a huge overwhelming problem.
Yeah.
But then on other days, I look at a beautiful photo or a beautiful video particularly, or I hear students that we have taught who are 10 years old, who 100% get it. Like, you know, if we actually handed over governing the world to 10-year-olds, they'd probably sort it out in about 10 minutes flat and it wouldn't be an issue because they see very clearly and they are generally connected to nature. And things like materialism also in general haven't come into play. So I think, yes, it can be a bit like, oh, God, you know, we just read another report or whatever. But there are so many areas of hope. So, and interestingly, in the introduction, we talk about Dr. Sylvia Earle and Mission Blue's Hope Spots. And CCMI have just released their 2020 Healthy Reef Report, which shows that the reefs are in better shape than they have been for many years. So, and the fish populations are on the up. So there's lots of good news. And I think that it's difficult sometimes on an individual level to keep that momentum, but we must, because there are many good things. And also nature can heal itself. I feel very strongly that if you give it the right parameters, it can heal itself or adapt. So I think the harp seals are quite an extreme example, because obviously they do need particular circumstances to be able to breed. Do you think they can adapt? Do you think there's time?
I'm not sure, but I do want to give the message of hope.
Yeah.
And I do, I just hope there will be a few good eyes here in the future. And yeah. I also think that it's very complicated. You have nature and then you also have politics and
yes,
regulations about the fishing, and in Canada you have the quota to still hunt.
Yes,
it's not so easy. It's not black and white. So it's this whole group of decision making and then nature that has to work together.
Yeah.
So I do think if everybody realizes what the problem is, the decision makers might make better choices.
Yes.
Yes.
I do kind of feel that politically, actually, certainly with a change of administration in the US, without having an opinion on it, but
yeah,
it does feel that there is momentum and there is there is opportunity now, certainly for over the next 4 years, yes, to really get things done. Whereas obviously beforehand, on an international political level, that was pretty tough. So maybe there is hope. So you work with the United Nations. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
That's a bit a weird one. There was a United Nations photo competition. Yes. The first edition after a exhibition by Blancpain during World Oceans Day, few years back, and I entered and I had like two images of mine were placed first in different categories. And the second year I participate again and it was the same. And then the third year, because I was one of the Blancpain Edition 50 Fathoms photographers, I was invited in the store in New York and I meet François Bayet, who is a legal officer at the Division of Ocean Affairs and the Law of the Sea of the UN. And it's, well, you have beautiful pictures, but now it's enough. You can't participate anymore, but we need somebody to present the winners.
You've won it too many times, Ellen. You can't take part.
And he said, I do like the way you think about things. And I do like your vision on things. Do you want to present the winners if you don't participate? And I'm a yes person. Actually, after my dad died before I moved to the Cayman Islands. So that was 2000. And my dad passed away and he always told me, if you can dream it, you can do it. And since then, I also have the urge to live my life at the fullest, even if things don't go well.
Yeah.
So I said, well, yes, I can do that. And two months later, I was on stage at the reception for UN World Oceans Day in the hallway, actually, of the UN. And I presented the winners. And next year, they made me curator of the photo competition. So it was my responsibility then to find a panel of judges. And it had to be like a bit spread over the world, politically correct, male, female. And then actually I took it a notch higher and I said, well, I want good images to win, but not just nice, beautiful images, images taken in an ethical way. So I developed a charter about ethics in photography and also what you can do with your images and that you have to be an ocean ambassador, not just a photographer, for example.
Oh, wow.
Because I have a hard time seeing underwater photographers walking around with single-use plastic in their hands.
Yes.
That to me is like, why? Are you not educated enough to know what's going on in the ocean or the issues? Yeah, I'm quite blunt about that. And I do tell people in a polite way. I also don't want to point fingers, but I would tell them, have you not thought about it? Or are you not thinking about where that little bottle would end up? So I don't want to point fingers, but I do want to create a dialogue. And that's actually the goal of the 14 issues in the charter, also to take images locally. So even before the lockdown, we had this charter, because I see a lot of photographers making the most amazing trips all around the world. Like they go to one place and then they fly back and they go to another place and they fly back. And those are long haul flights.
The worst carbon footprint.
I want them to think about that. And I will not judge them, but I would ask, why not take a longer time and do two destinations than close to each other and then fly?
Plan your trip with the minimum impact. Yeah, 100%.
Or have you connected to a local goal close to your home? Because how far away is the ocean or how far away is a river where you can take images? So I just want people to start thinking about those things because you have to start with yourself.
Yes, 100%. I think that's amazing. I didn't realize you'd done that. So I knew that you curated it, but I didn't know about the 14-point charter. So well done you for putting that together. That's very, very cool indeed.
It was actually a thing we were thinking about for a longer time with a few photographers. One of the people is Adam Hanlon and Alex Mustard. And we were thinking about it, but it never got materialized. Uh-huh. And then it was IOC UNESCO who approached me to make this team of ocean ambassadors, ocean champions. And it was actually for them that I made the charter, but because of the lockdown, it never
happened, but
the UN was so kind to allow me to relate it to the photo competition. So it's all about them trusting me and me not abusing the trust.
Amazing. Well, well done you for making the change. I had no idea you'd done that. So well done. So I know that you, I know you support many education initiatives, and also I know you homeschooled your kids. So for you, what do you think really works in terms of getting people's engagement on this topic?
Well, it's a bit like the herbs, you pups. Children are very pure. And the younger they are, the most open they are. So if you can reach them early, education is the key to conservation. And that's what you know also, you experience it at CCMI, when you get those young kids and they just see the world with different eyes and they don't judge and they are sometimes appalled by what is going on and they want to help. So where does this willingness to help stop? Is it also education, or is this influences from outside that, oh, don't bother, everybody does it this way, or don't bother because they don't do it, you don't have to do it? I think if you can tell them at a young age that every little action is important, I think it will go a long way. And those kids go home, or they will talk to their friends or their parents or their aunts or their the people they meet, and they will, again, not judge, but share their knowledge.
Yes.
And I think that is a very, that's like a free promotional network to get there.
If it you, is.
And to me, just being in schools, and I'm that's what I miss a lot with the lockdowns, being in schools and getting this feedback of the kids, and they just, they sometimes they start crying when they see the pictures or they hear the stories, and they really want to help. So to me, it's the most important thing I can do, tell stories in schools and just get their little fire going and make it a big fire before somebody else actually finishes the fire.
Yes, puts the fire out. So actually, for anybody that's listening to the podcast, I think that there is a lot of evidence that says, you know, children, particularly between kind of 3 and 10, who have a very high moral compass about other people and also about the world, that is the age range to get them as immersed as humanly possible in all nature. And I know that particularly for climate change and some of the bigger, bigger issues like pollution and the, you know, the overfishing. And a lot of people are like, you know, well, what can I do? So for anybody that has that is a parent or is an uncle or an auntie or even a friend of people with kids, you can help influence those children, or just not influence, but just open their eyes to what nature is, and that will make a big, big difference. I think a lot of people think that they have to make monumental changes in their lives right now that are so big that we can't possibly manage them, and actually that's really not true. So before we go, Ellen, we have got them.
I do like they not influencing, because that's true. A lot of kids are influenced by their environment, but it's just allowing themselves to think and allowing themselves to see with their own eyes and then make decisions. That's the most important. So I do like that you corrected it a lot.
Yes. And actually, I think you find, you know, I have a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old, and the 5-year-old in particular will correct me all the time. So actually, it from a parenting perspective, it's actually easier just to kind of deliver the facts and let them go with it where they're going to go. Because more often than not, they get to not only an interesting answer and their moral compass is very much in place, but also they think of things that I'm like, oh, I haven't really thought about that. Which is slightly embarrassing, because sometimes, you know, it's things that I do for a living and I'm like, I haven't thought about it that way. That's really interesting. And they put this amazing, simple view on it. And you kind of go, oh, yeah, you know, I can learn a lot from you. I'm not going to let you know that, though. But
we need to learn to listen to our children. And I've learned that because I needed to, in order to give them the best guidance I could when they were very young. Uh-huh. Just listen what they say. They're quite interesting creatures, children. You can learn so much about them, and they do get you more in touch with yourself, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Or at least they are. Sometimes when you're having a discussion with a child, you stop and think. So whereas with an adult, you might automatically respond a certain way, Because in general, you're so conscious about what it is that you're saying to your children, unless it's the time that they've got to go to school and they've got to put their shoes on. But any other time, I think that you are very deliberate and also not in trampling over their thoughts. So it's a really good exercise, I think, for adults to have a conversation with small children who put it in ways that you go, oh, yeah, you're totally right. And actually, my normal response might have been something different if I wasn't talking to you age, you know, five. So, yeah, I think, you know, everyone should just talk to their kids a bit more. So on that note, we have Alexander, who is age seven, has got some questions for you just to finish off, Ellen, if you are OK with that. He is also an avid photographer, but not quite the ocean variety just yet. So he says, what is your favorite ocean creature?
Well, surprise, surprise, seals. Also gray seals, harp seals, harbor seals, everything with whiskers. This makes me happy. When I'm water with a seal, it's like the best ever. At my most dark moments, I just said, I need some seal time. And then I go in the water and they just make me happy. So I'm very grateful to seals.
Oh, wow. And what has been your best ever dive or free dive experience?
That must be orcas. It's a very hard trip to go on because orcas are marine mammals. They have a mind of their own and it's hard to connect. So you have to do a lot of efforts and you're cold. But once you connect, and it happened to me once on I think in total two trips, 14 days out of the water, that I jumped in the water and a female just looked us in the eye, and she came back and she came straight up to us and she clicked. So they have this system of communication with clicks and you feel it in your heart. And I also clicked with my camera and clicked the shutter, but I came up from the snorkel and the guy that was there, he's a specialist, Pierre Robert de la Tour. He's a specialist in orca and communication. And he looked me in the eye and he said, well, Ellen, how was that? And I couldn't speak. I was crying. And it was just, my heart was still feeling the clicks and I was overwhelmed. And I still, until today, I feel it. Mm-hmm. But because it was one of those encounters that was the closest ever in touching my heart, literally.
Wow. How amazing.
Yeah.
What's been your most challenging moment as a photographer?
I think environments, like the cold. And also, I'm like 1.61 meters. I'm not the tallest person. I'm also not the youngest. But I do try to keep fit. Mm-hmm. But for example, cave diving in the heat. I have lupus, so my skin doesn't react well on mosquito bites and stuff. Being in environments that are not supposed to that you hang out there for a long time is hard on my body. And I need to pace myself, but I do it. So I know myself pretty well. So I can just take more time, get my cylinders geared up, set up, bring them down. Sometimes it's like 200 meters. You have to walk in the heat because in caves, it's two cylinders at a time. Mm-hmm. On little steps in the heat with the mosquitoes on your face. So it's hard work. And that's the most challenging for me, and then drag my camera around.
Yeah,
also quite heavy.
And then you've got to do it all over again at the other end.
and then I still have to go for the dive. But as the heat is hard on me, also the cold. When you gear up in the cold for a long dive, like a rig dive in Newfoundland, and again with two cylinders in your dry suit, the gearing up, getting ready, that's the hardest for me. Once I'm in the ocean and I know I'm well trained and I'm in control of everything, I'm fine. I can take it. But the gearing up sometimes, that's the hardest.
It's a monumental faff, isn't it? And it's a monumental faff just going for sometimes in a dry suit. Particularly, I mean, I think for everybody else also listening, you have to time going to the loo absolutely perfectly because it's not okay if you suddenly decide that you've got to go and you're all kitted up and off you go. So yeah, it is definitely you're dedicated to the cause of with that kind of extreme environment, whether it's heat or cold. If you could ask people to do one thing to stand up for oceans and for reefs, what would it be?
Just one thing, Kate.
Just one thing, one simple thing that you people can do. It could be two if you really can't.
Okay. Well, I think that you have to be the change you want to see. So ban single-use plastic. And also, like, think about doors and lights. Wear an extra jumper when it's cold. Don't leave the doors open when you have AC. Just what you preach. It's all these little things that can add up. And it doesn't help when you say, but they don't do it. Just start with yourself. So I would also, I would say, put the finger and point it to you and think what you can do. And you can do a lot.
So do you know what's really interesting is I recently I signed up for a dishwasher detergent and also a laundry detergent that is totally plastic free and all made from eco-friendly products. And it's also a super reasonable price. And I order it and it comes, it comes monthly in a cardboard package. So they're totally as eco-friendly as they can be in the manufacturing, but also the use of the products. And every so often, I went to update my account or something, and it said, you have saved 516 kilograms of plastic. I've been doing it for a couple of months. It was really, I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. I was like, that's absolutely amazing. And this is something that's really simple and it works. And it's, it's good detergent. It smells nice. And they gave me the statistic that just went, you've done these three things, that you've reduced your use of carbon, you've reduced your plastic, and just from switching very simply to a highly reasonable and very good product. It made me feel positive about something that I'd done. But they're very good at summarizing it for you, because I'd have had no clue. I'd have just been like, oh, I'm doing this good thing. Where actually it's huge.
Being an informed consumer is very important, because we have all this knowledge and we have the internet and we can Google, and you don't have to look at the advertisements because everybody wants to sell their product, but do a little research and see if it's true what they say. And if it is, give it a chance.
Yeah.
You have no excuse anymore. I always say, in the age of information, ignorance is a choice.
It is. Certainly with Google available. It certainly is. Ellen, thank you so much for your time today and the amazing work you do. And we will definitely put your information on our website, which is www.reefresearch.org. And so people can come and find out more about you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kate. And thank you, CCMI, and good luck. I'm always a big supporter and I will stay or keep it that way.